That's the point. Not whether they're new. But with the false analogy of, say, geography, where newer maps are generally better than old maps, we start thinking the newer things must be better than the old things. Beethoven's pupils thought they were better than Beethoven. They wouldn't play his sonatas in public. Czerny never played Beethoven's sonatas in public. They weren't played in public for 30 years or so. Halle was the first, about 40 years after Beethoven died. They weren't suitable. Czerny wrote pieces for four pianos, with two pianists at each piano. Marvellous. Poor Beethoven, only one piano, one pianist. We think by breaking the rules, we'll attain inspiration and freedom. Don't teach the children by telling them what to do. Let them express their creativity. Well, this is just getting drunk on words. Enormous assumptions are hidden under this. And the teachers, there's a phrase on this which ought to be perhaps put in gold on some of our classrooms. It says, with the untrained, the things of heaven may take shape within their hearts, but they do not take shape beneath their hands. There may be inspiration and creativity there. It's arguable that there always is. But without some technique, without some restraints, without some forms, these things don't take shape under their hands. Now, I thought, as a something different, to give a little piece, if I can manage it. There was a great teacher of kendo who died in 1930 at the age of 66, and he had a great influence on the fencing and the spiritual atmosphere of the time, and on Zen. And a book of his life was printed privately, and a copy was given to me by a Zen master, Omori Sōgen, who is himself a fencing master. Well, this book is written, it's a compilation of things that were written sometimes long ago, 80 or so years ago. So it's in the old Japanese and it's fiendishly difficult. It was an enormous compliment to be given this by this teacher. The trouble is when you have to start living up to these compliments. And it took me ages to decipher the first few paragraphs. But when you begin to understand the conventions and the context in which this is written, then it's not quite so difficult. Now, these were collected from some of his disciples, and then they put together and they were recorded, and as I said, they were printed privately in a small sort of deluxe edition. And I translated a few for you so that you could get an idea of the connection between Zen and Budō, especially Kendō, and their daily life as it was reflected in this man. He never accumulated money for himself. If he was given an honorarium, he at once spent it on buying books, classics, Buddhist sutras, or works on the Budō, and he used to painstakingly edit these. He told children, try not to become hoarders. When he was talking to people, if someone said something unworthy or abusive, the master always took it and interpreted it in a very refined and worthy sense. And quite often the person then became ashamed and he amended his expression. Do you think it was gone?
As to the degree of progress along the way of training, namely the spiritual state attained, he used to say that if someone had not reached it himself, then however elaborately he tried to describe it in words, they would be useless. Whereas if he had himself attained it, then ordinary language would be quite sufficient. The master treated others with kindly tolerance, but himself with utmost severity. When he was thinking of accepting an offer to become the Kendo Shihan, that's the head teacher, at the famous Shoga University, he went into the mountains of Myōgi. He performed spiritual practices and conducted a self-examination as to whether he was inwardly qualified to be a head teacher. One of his pupils, the late Seki Kozo, during his military career, could shout at a soldier with such concentrated energy, that's key, that the soldier fell unconscious. When the teacher heard of this incident, he gave a little smile. But when he heard that Seki, in a rough game with children, had again used his ki-ai shout to make one fall unconscious, he severely reprimanded him in a voice grown suddenly harsh. In talking to someone, the master never spoke of any faults of the other. For instance, if in a supporter's party he encountered some noisy, vulgar shouter, he would disregard it and say something like, "In the old days, there was one style of giving silent support, wasn't there?" And follow this up with a further topic, and so lead the talk in another direction. One day, when he came out of the training hall after practicing with the pupils, he found that someone had tied a big dog to the gatepost, and it was trying to get free. He went straight up to the prisoner, and patting its head, where the owner came running, white-faced, and calling, "Master, be careful, be careful." But seeing that the dog had become perfectly quiet, he choked back his words. It seems that the dog was known as aggressive and vicious, and it had bitten people who had gone near it. He often said that, however wild an animal might be, if one's own heart is pervaded by the idea of absolute harmlessness, then the animal will do no harm either. Moreover, in front of the teacher, even a raving madman became as gentle and compliant as a pet. Too many to list are the cases where sick people, given up by the doctors, were saved by the master. And still today, there are many who believe that he was somehow like a god. At a session of spiritual healing, the patient had an indescribable sense of being pervaded by the master's spirit, till ultimately, the master and the patient became one. And in fact, just after a healing, the two pulses were taken, and it was found that the two pulse beats were in unison. When the master left the house, he was always on the lookout for books, but he never haggled over a price. Often the bookseller had got in something for the master, which, however, turned out to be of no use to him. Still, he always asked to buy it. And he often said, "If you don't sometimes get caught into buying a bad book, you won't pick up the rare treasures either." He was thus demonstrating the truth of the saying, there is usefulness even in uselessness. He often told us, "Every night when I review the past day, from getting up to going to bed, I'm really ashamed. Full of failures, full of failings." Up to the day of his death, the master never missed doing this spiritual practice of reflection. Hanging in the teacher's room was a scroll, brushed by Katsukaishi himself, which read, "Be sincere and without show. Never try to become great." The teacher often said that he would like to die while practicing kendo, or at any rate, die in the practice hall. The master was hard on himself, but magnanimous towards others. If, for instance, he was warned by someone against some third party, he would listen to the accusation of wrongdoing and then say, "He's just like me, isn't he? or we're all like that these days, and would not join in the condemnation on his own account. When a certain disciple was leaving him to go on military service, he asked the master if he would help him to select a sword to take with him. The master went in, and from his own collection chose just one, a kanimitsu. This alone he brought back to him, remarking that the others should not be exposed to choosing or refusing, but stay in the repository. The master never stinted on formal manners. The third middle school, where he was teaching at the time, converted a part of the garden into a kendo practice hall. When he came into the garden by the way of the hall, he always made a bow of respect. Often when he came across students sweeping the garden or cleaning the hall, he paid similar respect to them. In middle age, the teacher brushed on a self-portrait the phrase, "sincere as a clear mirror." He always kept this carefully with him. The conversation which the master liked most to take part in was about the art of kendo, swordsmanship. In a deep, strong voice, level or animated according to the case, he would pursue the subject untiringly. In some of his unexpected illustrations, hearers would find themselves unconsciously drawn and finally in complete accord with the master. They recognized that what the teacher said was the very essence of kendo. After hearing him even once, they seemed to become different people, not only in their understanding and practice of kendo in the practice hall, but in their daily lives as well. Like the sun, the teacher gave an energizing life to those who faced him. People felt something like a light, pure, strong, and overflowing with compassion, radiating from the master. The master wrote on the diploma of proficiency awarded to one of his pupils the single word, infinite, mu-kyu. The master had a very keen intuitive perception of right and wrong, good and bad. But when he thus recognized that one who faced him was a wrongdoer, he never had any expression of dislike, nor did his voice change. In fact, his behavior became more and more cordial and earnest as he explained to him what to do to follow the way.
Thank you. Well, I don't know if you want me to. Let's say this is about half of it. These were fragments which were collected. And I thought it gave some sort of picture of the teacher, even in these very short extracts. There are others. When he wrote to children, for instance, it says he wrote as if he was writing to the nobility. And some of them have this. Well, we had one or two. They had a great charm of humility and modesty. But he was one of the master swordsmen of the time. So he had both the what's called the death-dealing sword and the life-giving sword. And we can see that beyond the sword, which normally is a weapon of that can kill, there was the swordless, which gives life. When the, do you want? Do you want? Mm. Do you want? No.